Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today I have a very special guest, Dr. Michelle McMahon. Michelle is from the Yorta Yorta peoples of the First Nations of Australia. And I'd like to begin with an acknowledgement. We acknowledge the beautiful and unique country, waterways, skies, plants, seasons, and animals. We acknowledge Aboriginal communities, their elders, and their ancestors. We acknowledge the living cultures and their continuing worldviews, governance, ways of knowing, being, and doing. Michelle, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
I'm very good. Nice to talk to you, Simon.
Good, good. I came across your work when we were at the NEODA conference and you were presenting on relational ontology from your personal research. You're currently working as a coordinator of the Aboriginal Research Centre in the Victoria Health Organisation. Is that right?
That's right. Yes, I am.
Yeah, good, good. Would you like to introduce yourself a bit and just say a bit about your background for the audience? It'd be really nice to hear that.
For sure. My name is Michelle and I'm proud Yorta Yorta woman. But that is my identity. My heritage is, as you said, McMahon. So my dad's family's from County Clare in Ireland. And his family came over to Australia, Oz, and I married my mum, a Yorta Yorta woman. And we grew up like on farms, you know. I'm the daughter of a farmer, but it was a fantastic combination because it meant that I spent a lot of time outside, between dad's beliefs and my mum's beliefs, I didn't really see a lot of difference. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I got older that you start to name stuff. But I grew up running around outside, and then my mum loved books. Loved reading and learning. So I had that wonderful combination of always being discussing facts of life or matters of life. It was almost like a competitive sport in my family.
Yeah.
where'd you read that? Who told you that? You know, all that stuff. And so I think it was a great foundation as an Aboriginal woman to go, into adulthood and then go into study and go into research. To be able to say, hang on, I reckon there's some other ways of looking at the world, and then to fight for this position.
Yeah, very interesting. And did your mother pass on a lot of First Nations wisdom and knowledge and heritage, or did you get that later? Did you do that through research later, or was it both?
You're probably both. Like a lot of countries, the First Nations people were hit hard with invasion, colonization. So my great-grandpa was removed from his mum, mm-hmm. and his sister was as well. They were taken. But I'm one of the fortunate ones because even though my grandpa was removed, the government decided that, he would be better brought up with non-Aboriginal people. We still resided in the actual area. We still, what we call lived on country. That was a really powerful thing to be able to grow up still in the on Yorta Yorta country with the waterways and the traditional stories. And then, like you say, as I got older and I met other Aboriginal people and elders and asked a lot of questions, my learning began.
Yeah, well, it's so interesting. I live 20 miles away from County Clare, and it's one of my favorite places. Have you ever been?
No. I so want to. I have six sisters, and we're all who's going to get there first?
Awesome. Well, I'm going to invite you across sometime. We're going to do a First Nations workshop in County Clare using your ideas and my eco-leadership ideas, and we'll bring it all together. That'd be wonderful.
Mm-hmm. It would be.
So, you mentioned your grandfather, and there's a terrible, terrible history of the Stolen Generation. There's ongoing. what shocked me when I did a bit of research, and I've been interested in First Nations peoples for a bit, but I'm not really well acquainted, but just the continuing struggle and the continuing incarceration of young people, it's shocking, really.
Yeah. It is overrepresentation of Aboriginal children still being removed from their families, overrepresentation of not just adult men, but women and you know, teenage Aboriginal children being incarcerated in prison is skyrocketing in Australia. Yeah, so yeah. Even though these are very visual things that we see and there's statistics that make you feel sad, I think to go back, you know, to talk about things like what, you know, we're discussing today, you know, philosophy and worldviews and sort of talk about, you know, what happens. I think it's all interrelated. I think the statistics that we see now in a lot of First Nations countries for First Nations peoples are still related to, you know, what happened to our worldviews at the point of invasion.
Yeah, yeah. No, I totally agree. I'm writing a lot about modernity at the moment and just how I'm so aware that I'm captured in it. It's like you can't help but be captured in a kind of a way of thinking which has kind of been imposed on you, and it eliminates so many other ways of thinking. So let's start exploring that. So you've done some wonderful research. I loved your work on relational ontology. Do you want to say what that is and kind of where that worldview comes from and how you kind of use it and think about it?
For sure. It actually started out, I had to position, you know, what was my beliefs about reality when I started out as a researcher. Mm-hmm. Because in Australia, you've got to say that you have a quant or qual.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate to have a supervisor. She said to me, Michelle, you're a Yorta Yorta woman. Go right away and research what happened in Europe. What is the history behind quant and qual? What was the beliefs of reality for these two paradigms? And I did that. And I came back with the position, no, I'm not doing quant nor qual, and I don't fit in either of those categories. So I started, my first research study was actually looking at, you know, what is relational ontology, and I was fortunate to have the guidance and instruction from some key Australian First Nation academic leaders. So, my learning began, and one of the most poignant differences between I know I might offend people and I apologise, but for me as an Aboriginal woman, there's a very strong similarity between quant and qual, or
let me just say to the audience, quant and qual is qualitative research and quantitative mm-hmm. research, and that's how in universities it's a kind of a scientific approach which puts you into one of those two camps. So that, just for the audience, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, maybe positivist, like a scientific view that the world can be measured, or a relativist view that it's in human lived experience. Mm-hmm. So I had to fit into either of these camps. And but one thing that even though they are incredibly different, for me there's a central idea that's similar between them, and that is only human beings are involved in knowledge creation.
Yeah.
And at that point, I'm like backing up as an Aboriginal woman, like, whoa, this is full on disrespectful business going on here. What is this? Only human beings are involved in knowledge creation. That's how I position myself different to, the worldviews that were imported here from Europe. But from a relational worldview, there's many, many, many more stakeholders involved in creating ways of knowing. Humans are just one of them. So, all entities of country are involved as equal stakeholders in creating ways of knowing. You know, the riverways, animals, plants, the seasons, the elements are all positioned as equal. But the other area where the stakeholders is a spirit world.
Yeah.
So my ancestors are equally involved in creating ways of knowing right now, you know, even though they might have passed decades ago or hundreds of years ago, because there's a belief from an Aboriginal worldview of cyclical time. So even though I'm here now, I am equally, my ancestors are equally with me, and then my unborn great-great-grandchildren are equally, you know, in this time and space. The spirit world, our ancestors are also equal stakeholders in creating knowledge. So way more than the worldviews that I've been given to choose from, that only human beings create ways of knowing.
And that's a massive difference, isn't it? I mean, you've got three things going on there. You've got the human-centric, and you're saying, like, well, that's such a limited viewpoint. There's also time. I mean, the way First Nations people think about time, and you've been around, what is it, 60,000 years or something like that? And with this kind of a continual kind of a heritage and wisdom, and just the way you conceptualize time is, I think, very different from kind of this modernist kind of European worldview.
For sure, for sure. And I think the perfect symbol for that is the circle.
Yeah.
You know, it's not linear, you know. Everything is overlapping and on top of each other. I had I heard something funny. I was interviewing an auntie once, and she said, "Michelle, if the non-Aboriginal people don't understand, just tell them it was the longest longitudinal study that they could even think of."
And it is. And the idea of the spirit world, I mean, Max Weber kind of famously talked about modernity disenchanting the world and becoming disenchanted. And it was right, really, because, you know, even in Europe, like pre-modernity and pre-Christianity, the pagan world was a spirit-led world. It was kind of there was an enchanted world, the rocks and the trees and the plants was, it's part of us. And it's just something we kind of lost and became very separated from.
Separated. I think for myself as an Aboriginal looking at European history, I think there's been different levels of separation, like separation from country. And then separation from spirituality.
Yeah.
But then even maybe separation from yourself in a way, which has been interesting. And probably some other key areas. Is it okay if I say, Simon, some other key points for a relation worldview?
Yeah, appreciate them.
Is that everything is animate. That's another big difference. When I talk to people and I say, you know, I'm animate, the trees outside are animate or alive, but is this rock animate? Is it alive? And then you get people looking at you like, oh, I'm not too sure what the right answer is. So there's the absolute belief because of this that when I use the word entities, I mean like what I just explained. Do you know how with the relational view I say that there's ancestors, there's all parts of country, and then there is human beings. I refer to them as entities. That all entities in the life world are equal. So equality is probably another big point. And then a beautiful one, really relevant now, is the belief around renewal.
Yes, yeah.
And I heard this from a Native American scholar, that, you know, in actual fact, there is only a small ideal set of conditions for all entities to exist. And so, you know, an important part of relational worldview is this belief around renewal, and that we, you know, must maintain this small and conditions for all entities to exist, which really falls onto the next part. And that is the belief around oneness, that there is actually, in actual fact, in a relational understanding, relationships between all entities. You know, some of these relationships are visible and some of them are, you know, are not. So it's the belief in the seen and the unseen.
Yeah. Are you finding that these ideas are finding an audience more than they were a while back? Is there a greater interest? Are you finding that with the environmental crisis and with the kind of fires in Australia, that the people actually are waking up to a bit to start being curious about kind of these ideas, because, like, you know, we have to kind of think differently?
100%. You know, where we are as a global people, you know, around the environmental issues, but then also around our own health, because I think a relational worldview, because of how we position the significance of relationships, that, you know, just our own mental health and our own well-being and our own healing from trauma, you know, is really making the conversation more poignant.
Yeah. And how do you find working with such a set of ideas in a contemporary context? So, like, you know, I read some of your dissertation, which is wonderful, but you're having to kind of put this into kind of a modern university. How does that work for you, kind of working between these two constructs?
I think I talk often about you know, requiring a both ways approach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But also that's also holding a little bit of honesty, because, you know, we are in a world with multiple views of reality and multiple, yeah, you know, ontologies.
Yeah.
So to continue to just operate, you know, whether we're, you know, holding a meeting or whether we're developing relationships, to continue with just a Western understanding is kind of not the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, positioning that, you know, we have always been and always will be, you know, Aboriginal people, is positioning that we do live in a space or a landscape where there are two ways of knowing.
Yeah.
But I think it's very well received.
Yeah. I mean, one of the problems I've had, I was very interested in American Indigenous peoples for a while. I was over in America and in Mexico as well. And one of the problems in Europe and the West is that, and you wrote this about it when you presented, was about how First Nations people and Indigenous peoples can become exotic, or they become kind of romanticized, yeah, and you get used in a kind of a particular way, which I get very uncomfortable with.
It's my story for that is sometimes it feels like you're a decoration put on a Christmas tree.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we're an add-on. Yes. You know, the Western ways of knowing still stay the status quo.
Yeah.
They still stay the unnamed dominant norm. And then, you know, something that, you know, an Aboriginal person or First Nations person has to say is the exotic thing that can like hang on it like a Christmas tree. So that's why, you know, I know that as people talking about, you know, what is your view of reality? What do you think is real and not real? It is not really common conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important, because when we do start at the roots, you know, of, like you said, the roots of a tree, then that allows, you know, First Nations ways of knowing to sort of, you know, grow from their origins instead of just being an add-on to Western ways of knowing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I noticed that it can be like an add-on, like a bit of a fetish. Like people kind of use it out and they use a bit of the language or some of the ideas, and it kind of gives me credibility as a person, and then we kind of carry on the same way.
And it's to their detriment, because when it's done like that, is the word nunst, like small meanings are lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of Aboriginal teachings will have, or stories will have teachings attached to them, you know, and these are lost. You asked me before, Simon, about, you know, the how it is applicable now in, you know, in a contemporary world. There's one concept called relatedness,
mm-hmm,
that I think is really, really significant for now. And relatedness is a way of being with people.
Yeah.
It comes from the relational worldview, this principle. And it means that, you know, the word development is really significant in Western ways. You know, a person should do this at this age and that at this age, and then, you know, by this age should be doing this. Development is important, but not the greatest focus. The greatest focus is actually developing and watching a child go to adulthood and, you know, older adulthood, developing their own relatedness.
Okay.
Relatedness means, you know, how I discussed earlier about the entities of the life world, you know, plants, animals, peoples, you know, the spirit world.
Yeah.
Relatedness is a person developing knowledge about the entities in their world,
mm-hmm,
you know, from a localized perspective. And like if I was to develop relatedness with you, Simon, I might start off like with a small amount, like, you know, your name, you know, what footy team you play for, you're married, you're not married, but then I might go on and learn deeper. You know, Simon thinks he's funny, but he's really not that funny. He's got three sisters, you know, whatever it is. And then you're at more levels. I heard an auntie talk about relatedness, like, you know, the rings in a tree. When you cut a tree, you see the rings.
Yes, yes.
So it's important for people to grow increasing sets of relatedness. And the beautiful thing about relatedness is that the more knowledge you have about an entity, whether it's a human or animal, you actually are also increasing your responsibility to that entity. So the more I come to hold knowledge about you, Simon, the more I am actually responsible to you. So it's like a two-way interplay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, when I first heard you talk about relational, I was going to say to you, isn't that a problem? Because like people like me, we immediately think relational between people. It's like, you know, we're so human-centric. That's what I think.
Yes, so human-centric, definitely. Like, you
know, I'm teaching a coaching course at the moment, and I have one of my frames is relational analysis. And it is mostly between people. I do say, you know, we're also related to technologies, to material things, to, you know, a child relates to their teddy bear. You know, we relate to our kind of mobile phones, even we relate to kind of the, we relate to our environment. If you're in a beautiful kind of a parkland, or if you're in a kind of cold concrete bunker, it makes a difference, you know. So we you know, I'm starting to bring it in, but like, you're absolutely right. We're so human-centric. We just think about kind of the human pieces.
For sure. When I run workshops with people, like I might have, you know, 20 or 30 people in a workshop, I'll actually get them to introduce themselves to each other from a relational worldview.
Yeah.
So if I was to introduce myself to you, like I did at the beginning of this, that was a Western introduction. Yeah. You know, I said my name, I'm a woman, this is where I work, blah, blah, blah. But if I was to introduce myself from a relational worldview, you would have learned also that I'm a river woman. That the crow is a very important animal to me. And the crow has particular teachings that if you knew those teachings, you'd be able to tease me and go, what you doing, sister? Well, you know, you're meant to be a crow. knowing each other from a relational worldview, I think creates deeper connections.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we talk about an oral tradition and song lines or tradition, how things get passed on. Do you want to say something about that as opposed to kind of the kind of knowledge-based written kind of tradition from Europe?
For sure. This is my next mountain to climb.
Okay.
I'm jumping up and down at the moment in the state I live in saying, come on, you know, give us some funding, because, you know, the Western world views, you know, which you know, some wonderful teachings around medicine and, you know, all the technology that we have, you know, so you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater sort of thing. But have had an actual fact, you can actually tell me, like, I'm not from Europe, but I'm guessing like 1,000 years of developing their ways of knowing or a corpus of knowledge in print media.
Yeah.
And, you know, this knowledge building has built upon each other, like, you know, through European history. But First Nations people groups who, you know, have gone through, you know, invasion and colonization and removal from families and, you know, land taken off them, you know, this is like, you know, hundreds of years of trauma, are now entering, you know, well, not now, but like in the last 100 years of entering the print media. So, you know, what we're actually saying is our way of holding knowledges is very different.
Yes. Yeah,
but, you know, give us space and opportunity to, you know, translate our ways of knowing into print media for the benefit of everybody, not just our communities, but, you know, as we have chatting now, for the benefit of everybody. But I'm really interested in positioning more how First Nation people groups actually have traditionally held their knowledges. Like a lot, like you just used earlier, Simon, you used the word oral. Like, I would challenge that word and say, come on, it's not sufficient. It's not sufficient. Because you know, for my Yorta Yorta community, yes, they were an oral society, but they also held their ways of knowing in stories, in songs, in symbolism, and, you know, to particular landforms in our area would hold teachings themselves, like a you know, a lake or a tree would also hold knowledge. Yes, I think the whole thing of saying that First Nations people are oral societies is simplistic.
Yes, I mean, you got your art, and your symbolic world is expressed in many ways. Yeah, that's very interesting. Stories. I mean, you talk about yarning as well. What does yarning mean?
I love the way you say it, yarning. I suppose it's a particular way of chatting. And I would say that you and I are yarning now.
Okay.
You know, if you're yarning with someone, then you're just human beings, down to the bare. There's no hierarchy. There's no, professional jargon, like who can say what, all that type of stuff. We're just human beings. You know, a lot of times with yarning, we'll talk about yarning circles.
Yeah, yeah.
So that means, you know, on purpose, again, we've got the circle again, you know, equality, everyone in the circle is equal. And then because of relatedness, there's particular ways of expressing equality, and humour is one of them. So, yeah. You know, at the beginning of a get-together where people yarn, it will start off with each other teasing the heck out of each other. And, you know, that is fun, it's mm-hmm. it's enjoyable, but it's also saying in another way, I see you as an equal.
Okay.
So there's meaning behind the yarning. And
I was reading a guy, Gary Snyder, many years ago, and he studied Zen Buddhism, and he was an American beatnik, and he spoke about, he was a very relational thinker as well, and he said that you can never understand your country unless you walk it. And it really spoke to me. And I went from Johnny Groats to Land's End, which is from the top of the Great Britain to Scotland, right down to the bottom. It was a kind of a 5-year trek, and we did it in pieces. And it was inspired by that, about how you know your country by walking the country. And our relationship to land and place and country, we're so separated. Yeah, that's all I can say. And it's a very important part of First Nations thinking, isn't it?
Very important part. Like, there's two very conflicting things between Western ways of knowing and First Nations. You know, First Nations is localized.
Yeah.
So you could call it a land-based way of being, or a land-based way of creating knowledges, where as a First Nations person, I'm always coming up against Western universalism. Like, yes. You know, someone in some country will come up with a concept idea, and bam, it's good for everybody.
Yeah. So if you go to a different place or different kind of a tribal group, then they'll have their own knowledge, their own wisdoms, their own history, their own stories, their own.
100%. And that is part of a relational worldview. It isn't a localized ontology. So because, you know, I said, you know, many entities are seen as equal stakeholders in creating ways of knowing.
Yeah.
If trees and particular ancestors and particular waterways are equal stakeholders in ways of knowing, that means if I shift to a different landscape, I'm in a different, what I would call epistemology from a relational worldview.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, there are different entities. And so, you know, all of these, I say infinite epistemologies, you know, for thousands of years have created different cultures, different languages, you know, different ways of knowing, but it's come from a possibly similar philosophy that includes knowledge construction is land-based.
Yes, yeah. That's very interesting. And, you know, I see a huge problem in that universality in the management world and workplace, is because they sort of train managers as if you can manage anywhere. It's like a universal skill. So if you train a manager, they can run a hospital in Australia, or they can run a car factory in America, or they can, you know, it's the same set of skills. And I'm like, no, it's all local and specific. You know, it depends on like what you're producing, where you are, what the local culture is, kind of, you know, has to be kind of locally based. Yeah.
And that's not taking into account relationships at all.
No.
You know, or relatedness, because, you know, there'd be small changes and really big changes every time you go to a different landscape and different people, you know, so many differences.
Spirituality, talk a bit about spirituality from First Nations perspective. Let's talk a bit about how the world is animated. What does that mean? Can you go a bit deep into that, Michelle?
So my beliefs about spirituality, I think that it's very, very much positioned in a relational worldview, because my spiritual beliefs are that I am no better than a tree. A tree is no better than me. So, you know, I can see spirituality in, you know, the sand that I'm walking on, you know, a particular breeze. I remember when I was working at a different Aboriginal health organisation, and we had a manager and we had a small team. We're leaving the building, and our manager, who was an older Aboriginal woman, she saw a particular bird fly over our heads as we were getting into the cars to go to, you know, department meeting. She backed up. She said, I'm not coming. You know, her spiritual beliefs with what that meant for that particular bird to cross her like that. Mm-hmm. So there's spirituality and meaning in everything. So that's why we talk about, you know, relationships, seen and unseen. because you're constantly, you know, seeing the world in that way and, you know, deriving a meaning and understanding. There's a really a beautiful, similar to what you're talking about, Simon, First Nations people will position that we believe in revealed knowledge. Western ways of being is that knowledge can be measured or knowledge can be experienced, you know. Revealed knowledge is where, First Nations people do believe in knowledge coming to us, you know, through measurement and through experience. But a revealed knowledge also says that we can learn, you know, through spirituality, through our dreams, through our intuition, through our gut instinct, through animals that come into us, you know, on a particular day, through our DNA. Our DNA holds, you know, ancestral memories that can inform us. And all of them are put into revealed knowledge, which is a particular way of being.
Yeah, and it's very connected to this equality. Like in most westernized religions, or not even western, a lot of eastern religions, you have like a kind of inbuilt hierarchy of a priesthood or a special caste, or you have, you know, God set up in heaven who kind of oversees the whole gig. But you don't have anything like that. It's just relational. It's kind of equal, and this revealed knowledge can come from anywhere. Yeah.
In actual fact, from my PhD, when I looked at 10 Aboriginal communities around Australia, their belief was that children can come up from country. Okay. So, you know, not a stork or not heaven or something like this, that, you know, in that spiritual belief around relationships, that that there's a beautiful interplay between, you know, parents and the particular land that they're on and particular waterways. So a father having a dream is actually the first indication of pregnancy, because the father has his own relationship to country, you know, and then they'll look at what, you know, there's a belief that children reside as spirit children in country, but particularly waterways. So, you know, when a father has a dream, it'll be like, oh, maybe I went fishing or swimming somewhere. And so there is that continual interplay where humans are not separate from country. But, you know, we're constantly in relationship.
Yeah. This has so many applications to the way we live, like individually, socially, how we kind of and I'm thinking about organizations. You know, a lot of our work is about how we transform organizations for this age we live in, which is an age facing environmental crisis, social kind of transformation. A lot of mental health issues, a lot of well-being issues. You're very aware of that in the health sector you work in. And these ideas are more than just interesting ideas from the past or from a different people. They're something which can really help us, I think, change the way we see the world, organize ourselves, engage with the natural environment. I think that there's a lot of application here, and it's I think you've got a lot of work to do, Michelle, to share these ideas widely.
What I like to position, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, we are not the minority. You know, it's so interesting, you know, people from Western European will position themselves as the majority when, in actual fact, relational worldviews have a deep history in, African countries, South American countries. I've heard Sami people speak from, I'd say, the Nordics, Norway area, the Americas, Canada. So in actual fact, the people groups that are positioned as minorities, you know, ontological, are actually the majority. So I think it's a lot of, healing for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think they speak to, like the printing press was 1650s or 15 kind of 50s in Germany, and it like that was transformational. Modernity is only like 250, 300 years old. It's like, you know, it's such a time, you know, before that we were in the same position. We were kind of relational in our thinking. The world was animated and enchanted, and like, you know, so it's close to us. It's so close to us. We can touch it. And I think people kind of get it, like not just a cognitive sense, but at a physical and at a spiritual sense. I think people kind of do get this kind of even in Europe and the West.
Can I ask you a question, Simon? Because I'm interested.
Yeah.
Why do you think from what you're saying, why did that occur? Like, I do wonder, as an Aboriginal woman, you know, what happened in Europe? Why was there a shift away from, you know, relational beliefs you know, from being connected to land to more of a, you know, separate hierarchical sort of more positioning.
Yeah, I mean, why it happened, I don't know. I mean, you can do an analysis of power and control, and you know, science gave people, you know, you had better weapons, so you control people. You could, you know, I mean, modernity for me is, you can simplify it and just say it's all about division and control. It's all about, okay, always about division and control. And whether you apply modern ideas to the workplace, it is about dividing labor up. So rather than a craftsman making a beautiful chair, it was about kind of putting 100 people on a production line and making them 1,000 chairs, but each person lost their personality, lost their skill. You know, there's a huge...
Yeah, yeah.
And it's always about that. And it's always about division. It's always about, you know, can we control nature? Can we control human nature? Can we civilize people? so-called, you know.
So in a way, cutting yourself off from your own family.
Yeah, yeah.
And your own support, because, you know, all of those entities are our support systems. Like I'm in a house now, like everyone in the world going through COVID. But, you know, I'm not alone, you know, with the river right there and, you know, particular animals and spiritual beliefs, I'm not as cut off as, you know, if I wasn't, you know, able to stand in my relational understanding. Which is a real blessing and fortunate for me.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, and we got cut off from our communities and from nature. And I think there's a fantasy, like we got sold, which is that, you know, if you could control nature, if you could control your irrational human nature, that you could become a better person, that you go to heaven, that you get richer, you get, you know, you get all these material benefits. You know, there's a fantasy that we can actually control this stuff. What's interesting now is that fantasy has been blown apart. Like, you know, the environment's doing its own thing. It's like, you know, we've messed up, you know. Stop. It doesn't work. You know, we've got mental health issues, you've got well-being issues. Like, you know, this fantasy that we can control kind of the environment around us is kind of being blown out of the water. So now it's opened up a space which is enabling us to think differently, I think, I hope.
But I hold high hope. I believe, you know, stepping into the future where there's opportunity and space for both ways of knowing, because Western science and Western humanism has brought a lot of beautiful things to, yeah, you know, our, yeah, knowledge base. But then, you know, as far as innovation goes and sustainability goes, First Nation knowledges that come from or stem from and principles, some of the principles I've discussed today, which come from relational worldview, will, you know, accelerate innovation, especially when we're, you know, working together.
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely certain of it. And there is a kind of rising interest in, you know, in the work I'm doing around ecosystems in the workplace and connecting workplaces to the wider environment and to wider social and environmental kind of issues. There's a huge kind of interest in it. So I'm sure that kind of that weaves into kind of the work you're doing. This has been an absolutely fascinating conversation, Michelle. We come to an end. I ask all my guests a couple of questions at the end. I ask them what to reflect on what it means to live a good life and to create a good society. And I wonder how you just respond to those questions. What it means to live a good life and to create a good society. Any thoughts you have from your perspective?
I think identity. I think whether you're Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal, whatever country you live in, being, you know, standing on 2 feet in your own identity, which is probably shifting away from, you know, I struggle with this word, homogenous. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think as we maybe have a bit of a giggle and a laugh and stand proud with who we are, even though we may be positioning some differences, we will actually then also develop, learn how similar we all are.
Yes,
and you know, and I think that's where we step forward towards what you call a good society.
Fabulous, Michelle. Thank you very, very much. I'm looking forward to meeting you in County Clare one day, and I hope you can take me around Australia one day and to your country. So beautiful 100%. Conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. We'd also like to thank our sponsoring organisation, the Eco Leadership Institute. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more about related events, our coach and leadership training, or our webinars, contact Simon at analytic network.com. www.ecoleadership.com or go to www.eco-leadership.institute. Thank you for listening.